In this meeting, and the recording has just begun. So good morning, everybody. This meeting is being recorded. It's 8:30 a.m. on September 27th, 2022. After you, Dr. King, after you call the meeting to order, we'll do a roll call of the board members and staff.
Okay. I call the meeting to order for the regular session meeting, September 27th, at 8:30 a.m.
Thank you. Dr. King?
Present.
Dr. Bastillo?
Present.
Mr. Leone?
Present.
Mr. Greer?
Present.
Mr. Barton?
Present.
Ms. Cardoza?
Present.
Ms. Crowley?
Here.
Ms. Richardson, we know, is absent. And my name is Judy Chepius. Let the record show that Ms. Richardson is absent. Dr. King, the meeting is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We'll start with agenda item number 3, review consideration for action approving the regular session meeting minutes from August 23rd, 2022. Are there any corrections or discussion? Okay, do I have a motion to approve?
I move that we accept the
It's okay. Meeting minutes as printed.
Second.
Okay. There's no further discussion. We'll move to take a vote.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the August 23rd, 2022 regular session meeting minutes. Dr. King?
Abstain.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Great, thank you. So we'll move into agenda item 4, application for licensure and certification. 4A, this is for review, consideration, and possible action for PT applicants requesting an ADA accommodation. The first applicant on the list is Stephanie Brown. Is Stephanie Brown present? Okay, I don't think she's present. So, board members, have you had a chance to read her application, and are there any questions or discussion?
This is Mr. Greer. I reviewed the application, and I do not see a disability that impairs a major life function, and so I would move to deny the request.
I would second that.
Okay, so we have a motion to deny and a second. Are there any other discussion points or perspectives? Okay, without hearing any, then Judy, let's call the vote.
It has been moved and seconded to deny the request for ADA accommodations from Ms. Stephanie Brown. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo? Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
He's muted, but he said yes.
Mr. Barton.
Sorry, I said yes. I was muted, but yeah, it was in the affirmative.
Motion passes.
Okay. Number 2A2, applicant for ADA accommodation is Emily Marsk. Is Emily on the call by chance?
Present.
Hi, Emily. You have requested an ADA accommodation for the licensure exam. Are you open to answering some questions from the board? Okay,
yes.
Great. Board members, do you have any questions or a discussion regarding the application?
Yeah, hi, Emily, can you just explain for us, I read through all of your report and everything, but can you explain to us how this, the partial seizure disorder affects any major life functions within your life? Not necessarily test related type things, but just things that you have to do on a daily basis.
Yes, so there are things that I've had to actually, since I've been diagnosed, cut out of my life. I used to work out at home. I do not work out at home alone. I'm not allowed to swim alone anymore, and that was a big part of my life. Other than working out, being in new environments, I actually had a seizure at one of my clinical rotations. On the very first day. So it was not a great start. A lot of it has been kind of come down to, being in new environments, being nervous. Unfortunately, yes, this exam makes a lot of people nervous. And I don't want to obviously blame it all on that, but there's just some things that has come up. School, at the beginning of school, I was having a lot of seizures. And that's actually when I finally got diagnosed after having seizures for about 10 years.
Is there anything that was put in place during your clinical rotations after that happened on the first day? You know, because this was something that you were going through, is there anything that the places that you were at had to do just to help you through that?
So I had a protocol written out for every clinical rotation. It had emergency call numbers. So if I had a seizure for less than 10 seconds, they were able to call my husband or my father, and they were able to come and get me. As having a seizure kind of knocks you out for a good 24 to 48 hours to recover from the postictal experience. And then if it were longer than 10 seconds, moving up to 30 seconds or more, it was to call 911.
Okay. That's so all the questions I have for now. Sorry.
Thank you. This is Karen Bustillo. So if you had the unfortunate event of having a seizure at some point during the examination, you would have to leave the examination and reschedule. Am I
Correct.
Understanding that? Okay.
Correct.
So more time wouldn't necessarily make that fact of having to leave the examination change?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Emily, it's Kelly King. Thank you for your answers. I just have one quick question. So similar to what Dr. Bustillo had asked, your request was to for some extra time. In what way do you think the extra time would be helpful for you to try to potentially avoid having a seizure, which
So in new environments or different situations that I'm not used to being in, I've started to kind of adopt some like meditation lifestyle kind of, and so it was more just between each section. If something were to come up, I can at least step out for possibly more than 5 minutes. I know each section, if you were to time it correctly, about an hour would be ideal, as there are 50 questions in each section. To be able to finish that, let's say you took a minute for each question and then were able to review all the questions, I would not have time to step out and just kind of do a mini meditation, make sure that my body is able to just kind of recoup and be able to continue.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Are there any other questions for Emily?
Yeah. Emily, this is Joshua Barton. When was the last time you had a seizure?
So I had a seizure actually during a practice exam back in the beginning of August.
And you mentioned, when you've spoken to us here today, you've mentioned a couple of times that the primary driver, you believe, is being in new situations. Is that correct?
New and stressful environments, just general life stressors.
Okay. And so the concern for the exam, is it just that this is a stressful situation?
Stressful situation being a new environment as well, because you're in a small cubicle.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that you mentioned that you have a practice now of doing some kind of meditation that you feel like helps you with that process, correct?
Correct.
Is there a reason why you think you would have to engage in that meditation process during the exam, or do you think that's something you could do prior to the exam, kind of as part of, you know, the preparation we all do when we're getting ready for these tests?
Sorry, I apologize. It paused for like about 10 seconds. Can you repeat the last?
Sure. Do you think you could do the meditation process that you have prior to the exam and then take the exam in the normal time frame? Or is there a specific reason you feel like you need to be able to do it during the breaks in the middle of the exam?
Part of it is, yes, I can do it prior. But again, being in that, what it's kind of like when I step into a new environment, my body almost kind of is like, oh, this isn't normal. This isn't something you're used to, which I know that's something that you have to get over. But unfortunately, being diagnosed with this, I've tried to do that, especially considering like my clinicals. This was more just kind of to prevent something to happen, because I would really love to not have to reschedule this exam in the future if I'm not able to complete it. Stepping out between each kind of just keeps that calmness going throughout the exam, if that makes sense.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Ms. Taylor, do you feel like this is something that is also going to affect you moving forward? You know, saying, you know, you go into the exam, you pass the exam, you start working somewhere as a physical therapist. Do you feel like this is something that's going to also affect just your everyday life when it comes to work? Are you going to have to put certain methods in place, you know, to try and prevent that at work? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
So typically I get about, it could be about 30 seconds to 5 minutes of that kind of epileptic aura. I know a lot of people know about. And so with that being said, I've talked to people from my school, people that I hope to work for, kind of say, hey, if I start to feel this way, I will be stepping out of a session, and just make sure that the patient I am working with, I would respectfully excuse myself and be able to walk away and hopefully be able to sit down or lay down prior to anything happening.
With any of these situations, are these typically to the point where emergency services have to come, or is it usually something that, given however much time you need to kind of go through the seizure, that you are okay without emergency services? Just trying to gauge a level of, you know, kind of where you get to with it.
So in the last 3 years, I've had emergency services called twice.
Okay. That's all the questions I have.
Ms. Martin, this is Joshua Greer. Let's talk a little bit about the accommodations you were given during your clinical rotations. I understand there was a procedure in place to notify you, whoever needed to be notified in the event of a seizure. Were there any other accommodations provided to help you complete your clinical rotations?
Accommodations? No, I was able to complete everything to full PT student, if that is what you're asking.
And you didn't need any additional assistance other than to make sure everyone around you knew of what precautions to take in the event that a seizure occurred. Is that correct? Did I understand?
Correct.
Right. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Taylor?
Ms. Taylor, I have one, Dr. King.
Yes.
How long does it take for you to do this meditation process to kind of calm yourself and be ready to move forward?
I usually will sit and breathe about 5 to 10 minutes.
You didn't require any additional time during your clinical rotations to do that?
I would go in the morning and then have it usually between patients if I had time. Unfortunately, there are cancels throughout the day where I was able to break up the day and speak with my clinical instructors and just be able to sit and breathe. And then obviously at lunchtime, I did do that throughout multiple times throughout the day.
Okay, so you were able to do it, but you were able to kind of be successful with doing it in the morning and at lunch and then during any breaks you may have had.
Correct.
Okay. That's all I have.
I do have one final question for me anyways. What type of practice setting do you envision yourself working in?
I have gone back and forth between ortho and neuro. Unfortunately, with my condition, that's kind of what sparks that neuro interest. But I also do love ortho at the same time.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
It's Dr. King. I think, given what she's shared with us and her documentation, I would make a motion to approve her request for accommodations for the test.
I would second.
Is there any discussion?
I think this is a much closer case than most of them. However, I don't think this is a disability that affects a major life function that improves access to the test. I think the accommodation will help her improve on the test, but I think her prior history, especially the fact that she received no additional accommodations to do her clinical rotations, leads us to be that this is not an access issue. This is a improvement issue. And so I deny it. I'm going to vote against the motion.
I guess my thought process on it is in how it affects her access is if she has a seizure in the middle of it, that's limiting her ability to access the exam.
Yeah, Giovanna, I agree with you on that.
But the time frame doesn't affect whether she's going to have a seizure or not. If she has a seizure, she's going to have to retake the exam whether she has time and a half or not. The additional time, I don't think, is going to address that issue.
And that was actually going to be a question I had for everybody is, I know on the form the options are time and a half or double time, but can we potentially make a motion that is not for one of those? You know, she had mentioned that the meditation that she does that potentially helps the issue usually takes her about 10 minutes at most. There's three breaks within the exam. Could we approve it for an additional 30 minutes?
I don't know if I can modify that.
I believe that there are set types of accommodations that are allowed, that the testing center knows how to handle, that the exam knows how to undertake. So I think the accommodation categories, I don't think you can get creative with the categories.
Correct.
A couple of things that come to mind for me are that, one, she has clearly a medical diagnosis that's impacting her life, and not just the test, but any new environment. She's developed some strategies to try and minimize or mitigate seizures before they actually take over and she's done for. And if she's got extra time, it doesn't mean she'll use it, but it gives her the opportunity to try and mitigate a seizure if she feels one coming on without the stress, the additional stress of running out of time to answer all of the questions. She doesn't, you know, to me sound like someone that would take advantage of that situation, but having it and not needing it would be better than not having it and the stress of a seizure coming on. I suspect, given that I have had lots of clinical students, the accommodations were not necessarily written, but I'm sure that if she was in with a patient and her clinical instructor, if she felt something coming on, she was allowed to leave, versus generally a student wouldn't be allowed to leave unless there was, you know, a medical issue or something coming on for them. So even though it wasn't a written accommodation, sounds like it was an agreement with her clinical education facility that if she felt something coming on or a seizure coming on, she was allowed to step out.
So, Dr. King, that's interesting to me because I think, you know, I'll tell you right now I'm leaning towards no, but I agree with Mr. Greer that I think this is a very, very close case. And the thing that's making me lean towards no is, you know, I'm looking at the way this test is set up. There is a 15-minute break in the middle. And, you know, I'm just kind of trying to do the math here, and it seems to me that if there's an opportunity for her to do this meditation process at the beginning and in the middle, that's a pretty close setup to what she's requesting. And I'm not sure the time and a half really helps get over that, unless we're talking about maybe a break in between every section.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't, you know, the only thing that makes me a little up in the air is I just am not sure that I've heard anything that makes me think that there's a reason for her to need to take that break between every section as opposed to during those two times during the exam. But I do think it's very, very close. And so, I would be interested to know if that's the case. I know, Dr. King, you're saying that that's kind of a fairly standard practice for these clinical, this clinical education period. I don't know. I think if that's the case, I think that's compelling evidence. Would it be appropriate, maybe to ask, if that has actually occurred in this case?
Mr. Harris, can we ask her another question if it was a discussion after a motion is made?
You do have the discretion, Dr. Kelly, or Dr. King, to ask additional questions.
Okay. Mr. Barton, go ahead.
Okay. So do we still have, and I am, Emily, do we still have you here?
Yes.
So, Emily, during our discussion, we've been chatting a little bit about some of the kind of standard practices that occur during clinical rotations. Did you have an agreement with your instructors that if you had some kind of a felt one of these auras or these seizures coming on that you could leave the room and take care of that? Did you ever take advantage of that?
I did twice, and I was able to stop an additional seizure coming on.
Okay. And what were the situations in which those two times you needed to use that accommodation?
Early in the morning, right at the beginning, before starting our first patient, we had walked down the hallway to go towards the patient in a skilled nursing facility. And we had actually gone into the room, and I had kind of looked at him, and I was told my clinical instructor, something doesn't feel right. And he's like, go ahead and step out, go sit down. And I was able to kind of breathe. And then the other time was actually in mid-morning at an outpatient facility. And I had asked him, that clinical instructor, if I could step away. And he was like, do what you need to. Please make sure someone is in the room with you at least if something is to happen. And so I had stepped into the break room and there was an additional person in there. And I was able to breathe and also stop something.
Was the second instance with a patient? You were with a patient?
Both times we had been with a patient, and the first time I was not working with the patient, it was still my second week of the clinical rotation, and the second time was halfway through, and I had to excuse myself from the session.
Thank you, Emily. I appreciate it.
Are there any other questions or discussion for this particular motion? And if not, are we ready to take a vote? Okay, Judy, do you mind calling the vote?
It's been moved and seconded to approve the request for ADA accommodations of time and a half for Ms. Marski. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
No.
Mr. Barton?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Emily. Best of luck on the exam.
Thank you all very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then the next item on our agenda for applications requesting ADA accommodation for PT exam is Gabriela Garza Rodriguez. Gabrielle, are you on the phone?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here.
Good morning. Are you open to taking questions from the board regarding your request?
Yes, I am.
Okay, excellent. Okay, board members, I turn it over to you. Any questions for Gabrielle?
Yes, Ms. Garza, can you just give us a little bit more explanation into You had mentioned anxiety, difficulty with focus, spelling. Can you just give us a little bit more into what that looks like for you?
Yeah, of course. So I guess I'll start with kind of giving you a little synopsis. I was diagnosed with a learning disability as a child, and I was not diagnosed with the ADD until I was 30 and trying to get into PT school. And I was, I actually was informed that I have the type 1, the inattentive, which is, you know, typical to see more in the adulthood. So I have a hard time with reading. I have a hard time staying focused in stressful environments. Kind of like what Emily was saying, you know, PT school has almost like given me like PTSD because it's been so stressful. And so going into the new environments and being in these, anxiety exacerbates the symptoms of my ADD or my ADHD, whichever you want to invert it as. And so when I'm in school, I've had to learn my like coping mechanisms, but it's difficult to do some of those in the standardized testing situation. So that's kind of where that goes, but I tend to have to really, I'll miss the, which one is most, which one is least. And I have to reread things several times. And because of a learning disability, that's kind of, it went hand in hand with why I picked physical therapy, because as a physical therapist, I can move through things and feel my way through things. But in the test, I can't do that. You know, I'm supposed to be sitting. And so that's where the complications kind of come into, because I'm stressed and I can't get up and move, and I'm having to read things in black and white, or I guess in this case, the blue on the white, you know, just very like monochromatic types of settings make it harder for me because I can't use those coping mechanisms that I've had when I've been in school. But yes, does that answer the question?
Yeah. Okay. As far as, and you probably have seen, you know, heard a little bit of this as we were discussing the previous case, but we're looking also at how does this affect a major life function? So, you know, thinking about it in terms of your clinical rotations, was there anything where this potentially affected your ability to perform within those clinical rotations?
Yes, yes, it definitely did, especially when I did my home health care one. That one was extremely difficult for me because, again, I can't use the coping mechanisms that I have. Or like when I was on campus taking a practical, I was allowed to, you know, stop and think about things and write things out where other people, you know, were just kind of like answering questions on the fly. So I actually had to take notes on my phone while I was treating an outpatient, in the home health care. And I had to, you know, bring in tools to, keep track of time, like timers and stuff, because the multitasking can be very difficult for me. Or when I worked in, the inpatient rehab hospital, I was allowed to take my break. Instead of taking my break at the end of the day to write notes, I took mine in the middle because I have a hard time, being able to remember everything that I did. So my breaks were put at a different time. So that way I had a chance to reflect and write things out. And then, another thing was that, like, I just took a job position with the inpatient rehab hospital that I did my rotation at. And part of my accommodations with them is that they kept that instead of my break being at the end of the day where everybody else does theirs to write notes. Mine is in midday. And then I'm not working full time because it's so hard for me to process that much in a day. So I'm only going to be working part-time until I can build up with my own stamina, because it takes me significantly longer to process through things. And I mean, I feel like we're all aware of it, you know, life for us kind of tends to be like, okay, next patient, next patient, next patient, next patient, next patient. And that's where for me, what's really hard is I have that hard time with the carryover and not being able to use my tools. So yeah, I've had to learn to implement those accommodations, not accommodations, but these compensatory skills that I have. That's how I've gotten this far, is being able to do those.
Thank you.
Gabrielle, what compensatory strategy, you mentioned that you have some strategies that you utilize. What are those strategies?
So it kind of depends on the setting. So like in school, like with ADD, because I was on medications and the medications were significantly helping, but they were also giving me a heart arrhythmia. And because ADD medications are stimulants, it exacerbates my anxiety. And so it's kind of like a double-edged sword. So depending on the setting, so like an example would be like I had to sit in the front of the classroom to keep that attention. Or I'm very like color based. So I have to have like, I'll use like a lot of colors or like different fonts, like to help trigger my brain that this is what I'm looking at. So like when things are again in that very standardized, like everything's the same font, everything is the same, you know, black and white, or in this case, the blue and white questions, that's where my brain has a really hard time picking up the nuances and the differences. So that's why right now in this setting, it's more important that I have the extra time, because I have to reread questions several times before my brain picks up the difference in the words, you know, because it'll be like, with inattentive ADD, we have a hard time reading. We don't want to read long passages and stuff. So we don't see where the question gives you the whole synopsis and then it says, well, which one of these is the least likely? My brain doesn't pick up on those words very easily. So like for me, a compensatory strategy that I've learned was like highlighting or writing things in different colors, or when we were still doing like paper tests, I could like circle things and stuff of that nature. But it's now, like, it kind of just, go ahead, I'm sorry.
So have you actually been diagnosed with ADHD? I see in the records that you provided us that
the ADHD
screening you had was actually negative.
So that one was done by the initial physician that I brought it up with. And then I was referred out to an actual psychologist that diagnosed me with the inattentive ADD. But I also was diagnosed with learning disability as a child, like in elementary school. So it's not just the ADD or the ADHD. I also have the learning disability from childhood. When I talk about the compensatory strategies, that's kind of going hand in hand with it. I learn differently. You know, I have to approach things in a different way. And that's one of the reasons why I was able to go as far as I could with PT, is because you can move through PT and you can feel your way through, you know, what you're talking about. And, you know, it's very tangible. That's how I was able to kind of, that's almost like a compensatory strategy for me to go this way as far as overcoming my learning disability, is because physical therapy is hands-on and tangible. If that helps kind of explain. But yes, I was diagnosed with ADD in 2019.
Okay. And who's the doctor that actually diagnosed you with ADHD?
It wasn't the doctor that did the paperwork, because my husband's in the military, so we move around a lot. But it was a doctor in Washington State. I used to live in Oak Harbor. And it was a civilian doctor, so the doctor who signed off my paperwork didn't have direct access to the civilian doctor's notes. And she's the one that printed that off for me, and she said that that should be suffice, but...
Okay.
But, yeah.
So, the strategies that you mentioned earlier, the highlighting documents in different colors and kind of utilizing color schemes to keep track of things, is there a reason, and I'm separating that right now from the fact that you need to reread the questions, is there a reason that would require you to take additional time?
Well, again, anxiety and, you know, stress exacerbate my symptoms. And so going into this, I mean, this is very stressful already, you know, but yes, the biggest problem is the reading, though. Again, in that very standardized text, reading is very, very hard for me to do, and then especially in stressful environments.
Is the primary concern then just that the stress, the test-taking setting is stressful?
What do you mean, is that the primary concern?
I mean, like, is that what you feel like is causing your need for accommodations?
No, my need for accommodations is because I have a learning disability and I have inattentive ADD. And because of that, reading is difficult for me and I have a hard time focusing on small nuances in standard text. But on top of that, anxiety and stress exacerbate my symptoms, and that's essentially exactly what I'm going into, is a very stressful environment where I need to read for 4 hours.
Okay.
So it's kind of like they go hand in hand kind of thing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Garza? And if not, do we have a motion?
This is Mr. Greer. I would move that we deny the request for accommodation. I do not see a disability that impairs a major life function.
I second. This is Mr. Barton.
Thanks, Mr. Barton. Any other points of discussion? Or concerns? Okay. Judy, do you mind calling the vote, please?
It's been moved and seconded to deny the request for ADA accommodations for Ms. Gabrielle Garza Rodriguez. Dr. King?
No.
Dr. Bastillo, you're muted.
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Ms. Garza, and we wish you all the best on the exam.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, board members. We will move then into the consent agenda, agenda item number 5. After reviewing the consent agenda details in our files, is there anyone that you'd like to pull out of the consent agenda to talk about specifically? And so for A, we have 5 applicants to be approved to take the exam, and then consent agenda number C is a request for termination of a board order or early termination. Okay. Hearing none, I do have a motion.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All right, let's call
the
vote.
It has been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda.
Yes.
Dr. King? Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Yes. Greer? Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you. Right, thank you. Showing that we don't have any items to take action on or review for agenda 6, 7, and 8, so let's move into 9, and if we could, let's reorder a little bit to hear agenda 9C first. Agenda item C is 22, 28, and 21, 31, Steve Kempton, PT. Is that okay with everyone? Okay. All righty.
And Dr. King, just to make you guys aware, I am recused from this case, so I'm going to mute and turn off my video during this.
All right. Thanks, Giovanni. So this agenda item is agendized to review, consider possible action regarding requests for additional time to complete the psychosexual evaluation. The board may also consider and take possible action as it relates to Mr. Kempton's compliance with the interim consent agreement. So, Mr. Kempton, are you present?
Yes, I'm present.
Hi, good morning. And then morning. Is your counsel present as well?
Good morning, members of the board.
Kim Kent is present as well. Judy, do you want to give us a summary?
Sure. On August 22, 2022, Dr. Jessica LeClerc, psychologist of Oasis Psychological Services, was submitted by Mr. Kempton through his attorney, Ms. Kimberly Kent, for the board-ordered psychosexual evaluation. Dr. LeClerc was approved on August 30, 2022, and on August 31st, Ms. Kent reported that Dr. LeClerc's first available appointment is after October 10th. 2022, which is beyond the 60-day timeframe stated in Mr. Kempton's interim consent agreement.
and is therefore requesting additional time to complete the evaluation. This matters for your review.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kimpton, do you have an appointment for the evaluation?
Yes, I do.
Do you mind letting us know what's the date of your appointment?
October 10th.
Okay. Great.
Mr. Kempton or Ms. Kent, I don't know who wants to answer this. Can you just explain, you know, why it took a month to get this name submitted for approval?
Mr. Greer, I can probably answer that. And it might have been delayed because my understanding in working with most other boards is that they typically have a panel of experts that they already pre-approve. And so by the time I realized that this board didn't have that, then we thought about researching and finding an expert, and it just took some time. So I think that by the time he found somebody, I think he found somebody within a reasonable amount of time, but he couldn't get in after we located someone and then got them approved. So there's a whole process. You have to find somebody, you have to make sure there's no conflicts, and then you have to submit their name, and that's what we did.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm just curious, while we're waiting on the psychosexual evaluation, Mr. Kimpton, how is it going with the ICA and female patients and chaperones?
It's been difficult trying to find contract PTs or chaperones. I've submitted a few chaperones, and I'm submitting another one today, but finding someone to chaperone and then getting them approved by the board has been kind of difficult. So I'm doing what I can, and so I hire contract PTs wherever I can, what I can find work for me.
So how has your practice with female patients changed then while you're still trying to find chaperones?
So when I have contract PTs, they see female patients. And when I had a chaperone for a while, but then she's back at nurse practitioner school, and so I could see female patients then. But now when I don't have a contract PT, I don't see female patients.
So just to clarify, there aren't any female patients on your schedule right now? Because I think my notes showed that you haven't had a chaperone since mid-August.
I haven't had a chaperone since mid-August.
Okay. Yes. So there aren't any female patients on your schedule that you're seeing or responsible for?
So no, I don't see female patients.
And Dr. King, I think we should clarify something. In the beginning of the agreement, Mr. Kempton, you know, did see a couple of patients with a female chaperone, mm-hmm. not realizing that that chaperone had to be first approved by the board. When I learned of that, and that was pointed out to me, I explained to Mr. Kempton that he couldn't see anybody until that chaperone was formally approved.
Okay.
So he is now not, you know, since that time, which was many, many weeks ago, well, it was in August, he has not seen any patients. He knows he is not to see any patients. He has not seen any female patients. They have to be seen by another provider. I submitted a new name today to Judy just during this morning. He had sent that to me last night. And so I'm hopeful that chaperone can be approved, because it is affecting patient care. It's limiting and affecting continuity of care, of course. Yes. And so hopefully he can get his evaluation and we can have the entire matter briefed and heard by this board at their October meeting. That's what I'm hoping. But then again, I don't know how quickly the evaluation report can be done.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I just have a question, or I guess maybe for the board to just think about, you know, as part of our board's investigation, would it be, could we potentially subpoena some of the records and his schedule from the last chaperone to now, just to make sure that we can verify what Mr. Kent is saying, that there aren't any female patients on his schedule and he's not working with any female patients while we're waiting on the psychosexual evaluation and approved chaperone.
Dr. King, I think that's a good idea. However, I don't think it's really relevant for the discussion of today. I think today we're just here on whether we should extend the time for compliance. And I wish I had a better answer to my question of why it took a month to get it submitted. But at this point, I would move to approve the request for extension until October 10th to allow Dr. Kempton until October 10th to complete his psychosexual evaluation.
Yes, I agree with you. I'd also, though, like to amend, just because of the agenda item, you know, verbiage that taking possible action on Mr. Kempton's compliance with the ICA, that I think not seeing female patients is a big part of that. And he says he's not. However, I think it's within our purview and honestly our responsibility to make sure that's not happening, as he hasn't had a chaperone since August. So I would feel more comfortable seeing his schedule and records to date to just verify, trust but verify, that actually what he's saying is actually truthful.
Should we take both parts of these as separate motions so that they can be defined?
Yeah,
I do agree that we don't really have a choice. We want to get this evaluation done. Mm-hmm. We're going to need to extend it so it doesn't continue to go further out. So,
okay. So, Mr. Harris, would that be the most appropriate then to have two potential motions? Separate them out?
Madam Chair, members of the board, yes, if we could take them one at a time.
Okay, great. So we have a motion and a second.
Mr. Harris, do we need a motion to instruct our staff to request additional records, or is that just an instruction we can give?
If we're going to ask that the staff issue a subpoena, perhaps we can memorialize that in a motion to direct staff to issue a subpoena or whatever records you deem appropriate.
Okay, thank you. So, Josh, sorry to jump in on your motion. So you have a motion to approve the extension, and I think we have a second.
And the only discussion is we are approving it to October 10th. We are not approving it to October 11th. We're not approving it to October 12th. We are approving it to October 10th.
Okay. I'll second that if there's not a second. Judy, we have a motion and a second. Is that what you have in your notes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussion?
I did not have a second before you, Dr. King, so if somebody had previously seconded it, I didn't catch that.
Probably not, because I was chatting about an addendum. So we have a motion and a second.
Are you ready for the question?
Yes, ma'am.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the request for extension until October 2nd, 2022. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo?
Yes.
Mr. Greer?
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
And Judy?
Motion passes.
Judy, misheard. It's through October 10th. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Thank you.
So, Dr. King, regarding the other motion that you had discussed, the only thought that I had is, are we going to need to issue a subpoena for those records, or can Mr. Kempton and his attorney provide them to us without absent a subpoena? I don't know what the other members of the board's perspective is. I know, you know, you've obviously got a little bit more legal oomph behind you with the subpoena. That was my only kind of thought on that process.
Yeah, good question. Judy, have we requested records without a subpoena?
In the absence of Ms. Richardson to answer that question, I don't believe that's the case, but I can't say that I'm 100% certain.
Dr. King, I'm happy to have Mr. Kempton supply whatever records you request. I did want to point out that he has submitted many chaperones since this ICA was signed and hasn't been able to secure one or get one approved. But we don't need a subpoena in order to comply with this order from the physical therapy board. You're welcome to issue one, but I can save you that trouble. I will get you whatever you want.
Thank you, Ms. Kent. So then we don't need a motion for a subpoena, it sounds like, but we do need to request, I think, my preference would be to request medical records and schedules for Mr. Kempton's practice, at least from mid-August to the last time he had a chaperone.
And Mr. Harris, yeah. Do we need a vote to order him to do that, or is the request suffice?
Now, may I ask, Dr. King, would it first satisfy you to see his schedules? Because I think producing daily patient medical records could be very, very cumbersome for everyone to review. So I'm just trying to simplify this so that you get, you know, what you need for your accountability. And I think if we could start with schedules, and then if that leads to an additional request, that seems like that would satisfy your inquiry.
It sounds good to me. Certainly at the end of the day, I want to ensure that he's not treating any female patient.
I understand.
Does anyone have any other concerns about that?
Or? Kelly, you were freezing for a minute. You want to repeat that, please?
Okay. I hope I didn't freeze when we look on me, so he didn't happen. Mr. Kim's. Does anyone else have any other? Or do we need to start there and we'll go from there?
I think as an initial matter, the schedule is probably going to show us enough to at least have an idea.
And I just want to clarify, if I can, Mr. Kempton. So if you are supervising or treating or co-treating with any of the PTA, would those show up on your schedule or the PTA for a female patient?
I've had PTs that have covered my schedule, and they show up on their schedule. Not mine.
Okay. Okay, that satisfies my request for now, for sure. So I don't know. I guess we'll just put it into a request.
So the request, would you like my schedule and then the contract PTs that I had as well?
I think I want to make sure. I'd like to make sure that I have your schedule.
Okay.
I'm kind of torn about the schedule of a PTA that you would be supervising in case you needed to come in and do any treatment with that patient. So I'm thinking probably your schedule and any PTA schedule that you are supervising.
Right. Well, I'm not trying to hire a PTA. I'm trying to get a PTA approved as a chaperone.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you supervise PTAs in your practice, Mr. Kim?
No, not at this time.
Okay. I see. Okay. So then that would kind of be a point.
My only request, Dr. King, is that you specify dates for clarification.
I would look at the last date that he had a chaperone with patient care and go from there to present, please. Thank you.
And Mr. Harris, I feel that I may have muddied the water a bit, but we've decided we do not need a vote on this. Is that correct?
Actually, I think just for the record, we should memorialize it in a motion to direct staff to obtain additional information surrounding Mr. Kempton's compliance with the ICA as it relates to chaperone.
Okay. So I make a motion, just exactly what Mr. Harris just said. every request from Mr. Harris
is just, that's the best kind of motion.
Copy and paste that. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Okay. Is there any further discussion? All right. Then let's call the vote.
Unfortunately, I can't copy and paste Mr. Harris's verbiage into my mouth at this moment, but I'll do my best. It's been moved and seconded to direct staff to obtain additional documentation for Mr. Kempton regarding his compliance with the ICA at this point from the time he was last chaperoned until present.
Yes, thank you.
Is that good? Okay. Dr. King.
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo.
Yes.
Mr. Greer.
Yes.
Mr. Barton.
Yes.
Motion passes.
Great. All right. Thank you, Ms. Kent. Thank you, Mr. Kempton.
Thank you, board members.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Okay, board members, we are going to agenda number 9A, case number 2135, Ken Baldoff, PT. This is an initial review. Is Mr. Baldoff on the call?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Mr. Baldoff. Okay, I just have a script I want to read just to kind of help you understand what the process is for an initial review. So if you'll bear with me, this is the time and place scheduled for the board's initial review of complaints. There are two cases for the board to consider. The matters will be heard by the board pursuant of its authority under ARS 322045. For everyone's benefit, I will provide a brief summary of how the board conducts initial reviews. The summary applies to all cases that we will hear today, and I won't repeat this between each case. I'll first begin with introductions. I'm Dr. King. I'm the board's chairperson.
Karen Bustillo, vice president, professional member.
Giovanni Leone, professional member and secretary.
Joshua Greer, public member.
Joshua Barton, public member.
Okay, great. For those participating in the initial reviews, please be aware that we have read all of the investigative materials submitted. If at any time it's necessary to review to refer to a patient, please only use initials. In each case, the board will first hear a brief summary of the investigative report from staff. Once staff is completed, then the board will ask the complainant, if present, if they wish to address the board, and then the board will ask the professional if they'd like to make an opening statement. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking not to take time to repeat information that the board has already received. You will be given the same amount of time to address the board as it took to present the investigative report, generally around 5 minutes or so. Please keep in mind that this is not the time or place for the complainant or professional to address each other. The board has a civil policy that prohibits the use of any type of disruptive conduct. Those violating the policy after having been given the opportunity to modify their behavior will be removed from the meeting. Once the board concludes its discussion with the parties, it will move into deliberation. While the parties are free to stay and listen to the deliberations, we ask that you respect the fact that we are now discussing the case amongst ourselves and request that you not interrupt the process. The board's options include, but are not limited to, dismissing the complaint, taking no action, such as issuing an advisory letter or an order for continuing education, offering professional consent agreement, requesting the professional participate in an informal hearing, or remanding the matter to a formal hearing. Before we call the first case, I want to advise everyone that the initial reviews are audio recorded. Accordingly, it's important that everyone speak loudly and clearly and that only one person speak at a time. Lastly, as a reminder to the board, this is not an informal hearing. If you have a few questions that will help you better understand the case and take action to potentially resolve this case through dismissal, non-disciplinary action, a consent agreement for disciplinary or non-disciplinary action, please feel free to ask them. However, if there are a number of substantive questions or additional investigation that you feel needs to be done, then we would consider appropriately moving it to an informal hearing. Okay. So, Mr. Baldoff, we are going to hear Judy Chepias give us a brief summary of the case.
Thank you, Dr. King. I'm not sure, but I wanted to check first if the complainant, Dr. Mianger, is present on the call as well. Okay. In case 2135, the complainant, a co-worker of Mr. Baldoff's, alleged that Mr. Baldoff injured patient CD's left hand, causing a fracture dislocation during treatment, that he did not follow the facility's COVID-19 precautions, and he treated the upper extremities when it was not part of the physical therapy plan of care. Mr. Baldoff requested and received a copy of the the investigative report. The request was placed after the notification deadline, and he was provided a copy on September 20th and advised that any response would be presented to the board as a supplemental documentation or document. We did not receive any direct response to that investigative report. However, there was a late submission of a supportive letter that was in your file. The allegations include an injury, a fracture, a dislocation of the hand, the left fourth digit, to a medically compromised patient. Additional allegations of not following the COVID-19 precautions and treating the upper extremities when it was not part of the physical therapy plan of care. The complaint was filed by a coworker who's an occupational therapist. The co-worker was not a direct observer of Mr. Baldoff's treatment. Therefore, she was not interviewed by Ms. Richardson. Ms. Richardson found insufficient and or conflicting evidence related to the injury of the hand and the lack of the COVID precautions. Conflicting evidence was also found regarding the compliance with the COVID precautions. Ms. Richardson was unable to obtain the x-ray report, care home sign-in or out sheets that reflect the care provider's temperature checks and interview one of the staff members that had claimed to have observed Mr. Baldoff treating the patient's hands. Multiple requests were made of the care home without any success. The evaluation and treatment of the upper extremities can and should be a part of a physical therapy plan of care. However, Mr. Baldoff documented that because occupational therapy was on the case, he was deferring treatment of the elbow, wrist, and hand to the OT plan of care. Mr. Baldoff, on multiple visits, documented that he did not treat the hand, the elbow, wrist, or hands due to the occupational therapy on the case. He did treat the patient's shoulders. In Ms. Richardson's investigative report, she found that this allegation to be unsupported. The investigative report does find evidence of substandard care in the general clinical and plan of care for this patient. The evidence is documented in the analysis and the detailed chart review that was a part of your packet. The clinical issues for the board to consider is the efficacy of providing passive or active assisted range of motion and stretching over 18 visits. This is a patient that had very poor prognosis, completely dependent on caregivers for all care for many years. The focus of the treatment should have been on training the caregivers to maintain her current status. This is, in fact, what happened after Mr. Baldoff was removed from the case. The therapist that continued the care focused on caregiver training and discharged the patient within three visits. This case is for your review.
Thank you. Mr. Baldoff, would you like to make an opening statement?
I think everything that is in the documentation is pretty much as it stands.
Thank you. And are you willing to answer questions from the board members?
Yes, okay, I am.
Thank you. Okay, board members, do you have questions for Mr. Baldoff? Mr. Baldwin, I have a question. This is Kelly King. Did you at any point provide any training for the caregivers or assess how they were caring for this patient and update any activities or stretching or mobility for this patient?
Absolutely. And in my clinical notes, it stated that I did caregiver teaching and I would leave the patient in a position of comfort to enhance range of motion on her lower extremity joints. And the caregivers were individually educated in that, because I would get there at 6 or 6:30 in the evening. It was always the night shift. And most of those caregivers were Spanish speaking and would have to communicate with them in Spanish. How to position the patient for comfort and to increase range of motion of those joints. But at no point did I ever teach a caregiver how to mobilize a joint, because I don't think that is appropriate. It's a learned process to mobilize a joint, and it was just positioning for comfort education.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Baldoff?
Mr. Baldoff, why did you continue treating this patient instead of considering discharging her for lack of progress?
Because she was making progress. When I first engaged with the patient, she was basically in a tight little ball, contracted, hips severely flexed, knees, ankles, shoulders. By the time this all happened, the patient was sitting with good extension in her hips. She had her knees only at about 20 degrees of flexion. I was able to engage her legs and spread them wide enough in abduction to be able to place them on the outside edges of the recliner footrest, as I taught the patient's sister at the appointment time that she showed up. And she wanted to take pictures and was encouraged with the progress made that progress would continue. So she was going to bring a camera next time and take pictures of the treatment session. So she was making progress in gaining her functional mobility and comfort level. So as we know, as a patient's severely contracted, they're in more pain. And this patient had no ability to verbally interact. So basically, you would get your feedback through her expressions, her facial expressions. And so when I would perform mobilization, I'd be looking into her eyes and her face to see where she was in terms of discomfort. And typically when I left the patient, she was very comfortable and she was in a position to maintain the range of motion that I obtained. And then from that point, not long after, the caregivers would be transferring into her bed for the night's sleep.
Did the patient's progress continue on a linear track during your 18 visits, or did it plateau at any particular time?
No, it continued significantly on a progressive track towards a goal of less pain and more joint range of motion.
Thank you.
Mr. Baldoff, do you recall the situation around mobilizing a finger and causing, when you were looking at facial expressions or what, does that ring a bell to you, the situation that was part of the complaint around an injury to the hand?
Yeah. So on each visit, I would enter the room and I would assess the patient's range visually, and I always started mobilizing the shoulders first, worked on the shoulders, and then I would work on the hips and the lower extremities. On that particular day, I walked in the facility. There was the patient's sister who entered the facility about 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes after I did, and I heard her having a conversation in the living room with the manager. And then she came into the room maybe about halfway through the treatment, at which point I was already working on the lower extremities. We had a discussion of what occupational therapy was doing with the hands, and she wanted to know if I thought it was appropriate what was being, you know, treated, and I agreed. We also talked about all the pictures on the walls of the patients. Had maybe 50 pictures on the wall of her family, and discussed who those people were in the patient's life, so I could have a conversation with the patient when I was performing her treatment. We talked about her, the TV shows that she likes to watch. And we talked about the fact that apparently we had gone to school together at Catalina High School, and I didn't recognize the sister's name, but apparently we did. So that was what happened during that treatment session. And me wearing a mask during the whole treatment session, until I got outside the facility, the patient's sister didn't even realize I had a mustache until I took it off, and she said, "Oh, you have a mustache. You must look good in a cowboy hat."
Thank you.
Mr. Baldoff, during that session that you were just speaking about, at any point was the OT in there?
No.
Okay. So the as far as the accusation of the issue with the fractured finger, is that just something that came up when the OT went to see the patient the following visit or something like that?
I was hoping that Mrs. Richardson would pick up on this, but this is an ongoing years of working with this OT that we've had a problem between the two of us, and it's just one of those things where she's trying. Well, I don't know how to answer that. I didn't want to really bring it up, but. It's just a conflict between the OT and myself. And I think that's where this is coming from. She was trying to find something on me and tried to pin something on me that I think happened through actual caregiver. She was teaching the caregivers how to mobilize the hands, which I strongly disagree in. And there's 3 days time went by between my treatment and when the finger was x-rayed. Multiple times when caregivers were transferring the patient and positioning the patient, and it could have happened at any point. But I at no point treated the hand.
Okay. Then in regard to just the remainder of the treatment that you were involved in, and I know we've kind of talked about, you know, your rationale for continuing care with this patient for an extended period. At any point during your treatment of this patient, did you ever feel as if the education that you gave the caregivers could potentially be how it moved forward with that patient, where PT would not have been necessary anymore? Or do you feel like PT continued to be medically necessary because the patient would have regressed had you stopped therapy at that point?
You know, this patient probably would have benefited if I had to make a decision at the end of the certification period for possible maintenance therapy, to make sure that this patient maintained the range of motion that was achieved in the peripheral joints that I worked on. and to make sure that the caregiver follow-up was that they were doing the correct positioning to maintain that range of motion. That way I wouldn't, at least for, you know, maybe 6 weeks or so, to see if everything was followed and if the patient would regress. The patient was making progress and did not reach a plateau, but I think if she had, and if she got to her maximum range of motion before getting to a more solid infill on the joint mobilization, that probably would have been the direction I would have taken, would be to do a maintenance therapy for a little while.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Baldoff on the board?
Mr. Baldoff, you mentioned that I saw in the records that you that you had on a couple of occasions left the patient in kind of a prolonged abduction position during when you left in the recliner. What was the clinical rationale?
Yes, sir. The patient, as we know with contractures, the patient will want to go back into a contracted state. The more prolonged, like in terms of bracing of a joint, if you can gain a range of motion of a joint and brace it in the extended range of motion, then you're more likely to preserve that achieved range of motion. So I'm there for 45 minutes. If we can extend that, you know, that passive stretch on that joint after it's achieved, there's a greater likelihood that she'll maintain that until at least she's in bed and can relax, and that should better the outcomes of the treatment. And the caregivers were aware of what I was doing, and they, you know, they were, as I taught them positioning, they were you know, educated in that positioning for comfort.
Thank you. Dr. King, I don't have anything further.
Thank you, Mr. Barton. If there are no further questions for Mr. Baldoff, then we will move into the deliberations phase of the initial review. Is that okay with everyone? Okay. So there'll be no further questions for Mr. Baldoff, and we'll start deliberating the case. So, board members, what are your thoughts?
So I'll start here. I'm not upset with the number of visits. I feel like with the gains that that he was able to make, this is going to make dressing, grooming, diaper changing, and every other aspect of this patient's care much easier for every caregiver. I would absolutely agree with him that consideration of maintenance therapy at the completion might have been a very appropriate avenue to continue to go down. I just struggle with the inconsistency of the reporting, and my initial thought is to dismiss.
This is Mr. Kerr. I'll second that. I only was concerned with the length of the visits, but you know, I appreciated licensee's response and Dr. Bastillo's comments.
Dr. Bracio, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, having worked with, you know, pediatric cases who are severely contracted, trying to maintain any kind of integrity in those joints, reducing the risk of skin issues, you know, and pressure is just, you know, progress it looks a little different in that situation. And so I'm in agreement with you and leaning definitely toward voting dismiss.
Yeah, I would be in agreement with you guys as well. I mean, just based off of documentation, based off of the responses from Mr. Baldoff, I I don't see any reason why there wouldn't have been medical reason to continue treating the patient, especially if it was going to make things easier for the caregiver. So I would also lean towards the dismissal.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. If there's no further discussion, then we'll have Ms. Chepiez call a vote.
So that was an official motion, Dr. King, seconded by Mr. Greer.
Yeah, Dr. Steele made a motion to dismiss, and Dr. Greer seconded.
Okay. Dr. Greer.
Dr. Greer. Yes, sir.
It has been moved and seconded to dismiss case 2135, Ken Baldoff, PT. Dr. King?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Mr. Greer? Mr. Greer, you're muted.
Yes.
Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Oh, you're muted, Dr. King.
Thank you, Mr. Baldoff.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. All right. Have a good day. We will then move to agenda item 9B. Charles Sobotka. Is Mr. Sobotka on the call, please?
I am. Unfortunately, I'm under Mario Scalia. This is my wife's work computer at home, and her father, it's her father's company's account, so I apologize for the Mario Scalia instead of Charles Sobotka.
Well, thank you for the clarification. And then are you represented by Lynn Carey? And is Mr. Carey on the call?
I am here. Good morning, Dr. King, members of the board.
Good morning, Mr. Carey. Okay, so we'll start then with Ms. Chepiez giving us a summary.
Just double checking if the complainant is on the call in this case.
Oh, thanks, Judy.
I don't believe so. Okay, this case number 2208 was filed by Angels Home Healthcare administrative staff. They filed the complaint alleging that Mr. Sobotka created a false record and billed a home care visit when he did not see the patient. Mr. Sobotka is represented by Mr. Flynn Carey. They have received and reviewed the investigative report, and they provided a response to that report that was included as an exhibit in your packet. Mr. Sobotka admitted to falsifying the record and billing for a visit for a patient on February 10, 2022, when he did not see the patient. Conflicting statements by Mr. Sobotka as to why or how this happened include the following. His mother had terminal cancer, and he states that morning he received news that her condition had worsened. This caused him distress, and he wasn't thinking clearly. He did, however, continue with the remaining cases on his schedule that day. He gathered enough information from the caregiver to justify his documentation and bill a regular visit. He was having a difficult time with the software and the non-billable visit template, the software he had been using for about 1 year. This was a difficult patient. Mr. Sobotka felt that he could not treat him without breaking down in front of him. He did admit to falsification of the record, but that was not until he was confronted by his supervisor about 1 week later. And the investigative report identifies additional substandard care issues related to the plan of care and the communication with the patient about his discharge from services. This case is presented for your review. Dr. King, you're muted.
Sorry, I didn't want you to hear the coffee pot going off again. Mr. Sobotka or Mr. Carey, would either of you like to make an opening statement?
Yes, Dr. King, I have just some brief comments, and then I know Dr. Sobotka would like to make some comments. Where I want to start, and I think this is hopefully apparent in the interview that Mr. Sobotka gave, the initial response that he gave prior to retaining counsel and in our ultimate response, is it's not our goal here to try to over-lawyer this situation or maneuver through this situation by saying that the investigative report is incorrect, or really what we're focused on is, I think, what I would consider to be some of the mitigating factors. I'd like the board to consider this as we've all been in the allegation of falsified records before, and a lot of the time there's a significant number of them. They're done for a financial reason. They're done to avoid having to get one's work done. I think this one really reflects a perfect storm of what was happening with this licensee. He had a mother who was failing in her health. He had a patient who, when he previously approached that patient, was somewhat confrontational and did not allow him to start his plan of care with the patient until the patient finished breakfast. And I think that he, for lack of a better word, really psyched himself out that he was going to get into a confrontation with this patient. I think that the record here shows a significant amount of rehabilitation. He's done a lot of continuing education. In fact, a lot of the continuing education that I think this board would normally order in a situation like this, he has on his own researched and taken. I would ask the board also to consider his candor. He did provide some information regarding the software, but that was not really in conflict. It was more he discussed the fact that the way that came up is Mindy did suggest to him, why didn't you make this a non-billable discharge? And he did express some confusion over how that software worked. He wasn't certainly trying to justify that the software is what led to this situation. Overall, what we're asking the board to do is look at the mitigation and the mitigating factors. Also look at the very somewhat unique perfect storm of situation here and how isolated this singular incident was. And I think it's also important that this is someone who I think has shown that he can be regulated by the board, given that he's been candid. He was candid with his employer to his detriment, leading to his termination. And he was candid with the board, with Mindy, and also in his writing. And so I would ask the board to take those into account. I'd ask the board to consider if a non-disciplinary outcome would be appropriate here, given that he has remedied the situation. And truly, there's not, I don't think this level, these number of things could have conspired in the future for him. I mean, the idea that his mom, with the situation with this patient, all of it kind of came together at once, and I don't think it's repeatable. So that would be our request, is to consider this if this could be a non-disciplinary outcome. I would like to turn over the comments to Dr. Sabatka briefly. I know he wants to engage with the board directly, and Dr. King, he's certainly available for questions. I'm available, but I don't know that this is really a standard of care case where there's going to be a lot for me, but I'm available as well.
Am I okay to give my response now? Okay. Members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning. I cannot express how embarrassed I am by the situation. I was at a low point on the day of my bad decision and I cut corners. This is not how I was trained and not how I normally conduct myself. I've used this situation as a chance to step back and examine the circumstances surrounding my poor decision and consider ways that I can improve my approach to stressful situations in the future. I've learned a lot from the continuing education I took, and I finally understand that it is okay to take a pause if I feel that I need a moment to reset and recharge. I know that I have to earn back the board's trust, and I appreciate the chance to start that process by addressing you today.
Dr. King, you're on mute.
Judy, I'm going to win today for that. Instead of you saying with Dr. Cornwall, it's going to be Dr. King here on mute.
I appreciate taking one, Kelly.
Thank you, Dr. Sabatka, for your statement. Board members, if you have any questions for Mr. or Dr. Sabatka, please take this time to ask.
Dr. Sabatka, I don't know if maybe I missed this within the materials that we received, but as far as the billing issue, has that been remedied? Has that been I don't know whether it's been paid back or whether it was just removed immediately. Has that been taken care of?
I am not sure. I imagine that it would have been. As far as for billing purposes, I do not do billing in the home health. We submit the visits. With this was a Medicare/Blue Cross Blue Shield patient, and I believe it is an episodic pay. What that means is that the payment is not dispersed until the end of the episode. And so in that regard, I imagine that it was removed and there was no payment at all because this event happened on February 10th, and I discussed it with Jen Larson, who is the director of nursing, on February 17th, a week later, and it was nowhere near the end of the episode.
And that's what my understanding as well, Board Member Leone, is that that this was either corrected or reversed. Especially given the context between Ms. Larson and Dr. Sabatka's conversation, I think that they would have caught that. They certainly wouldn't have submitted a HICFA to get reimbursement without getting to the end of his course of treatment. So I don't anticipate there would be any kind of clawback from either Blue Cross or Medicare.
If you are not familiar with home health, with episodic pay, it's typically a 2-month or a 60-day episode. And so with specific payers, with payers, episodic. So in this case, I cannot see where it would have been billed out.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Saka, I just want to clarify that you had other patients for the rest of the day. Did the situation with your mom impact your full day and you canceled your day, or did you continue to see the rest of your patients on your schedule?
I was able to see all the other patients on my schedule. The reason that this patient was more difficult was the fact that on the initial patient, I felt was confrontational. And my threshold for dealing with confrontation was much lower. And this was the only patient who I was genuinely concerned could be confrontational. The other issue with it is that the call from my mother was right before this patient. So it was the immediacy of the incident that really affected me emotionally. So at that moment in time, I was absolutely not capable. My threshold of dealing with potential confrontation I would not have been able to, and I would have become emotional and such. So I was able to complete the rest of my day to my standard level of practice, yes.
Thank you.
This is Karen Bustillo. Was it your intent before you took the call from your mother when you were going to go see that patient that day to discharge her due to lack of progress?
It was my intent to discharge the patient that day, correct.
Thank you.
Dr. Saka, it looks like in the document submitted that you took 5 ethics courses in about 4 days, 5 days or so. So what were some things that you've learned from these CEUs that have impacted your current practice?
So there were multiple aspects of the CEU courses that I learned. One of the courses led me to the RIPS model, which is basically a way to triage ethical decision making, where you look at the realm or who can be affected by such an ethical dilemma, the individual process, which is a base morality tools to incorporate a decision making aspect, and the situation, which is the actual dilemma in itself in different ways. And this is something that I plan to incorporate if any situation like this arises in the future. Part of the issue of this was the intensity of the emotional issue. I mean, this was my mother. I genuinely thought she was going to pass of that day. Hopefully in the future, I cannot imagine another situation of this intensity rising, but using this RIPS model, I absolutely can come to a conclusion, which I have since this case has happened, where if I am not capable of treating a patient for any emotional reason, I need to step back. I need to recuse myself from therapy for the day if I need to, and just wait until I'm at an appropriate time or emotional state to be able to see these patients. I learned that I have a fiduciary duty to my patient. I have to hold the patient in their trust and not the other way around. The patient has no duty to myself. I need to be able to hold this duty to the patient. And if I can't, again, I need to be able to recuse myself. You know, there's various aspects of accountability, integrity that I need to be able to step back and take a look at before I make any future decision making. The basic thing I found is that for really, I feel with every other instance of patient care besides this, I have a strong ethical and moral compass. I am aware and I am very caring of my patients. I am very, I feel like I do a good job. I feel like I do the best that I can. But this incident, this event has really, in a way, been positive for me because it has allowed me to realize in any future situation of any similar magnitude, I just have to take a step back and reevaluate and tell myself it is okay to cancel the visit or cancel my day and come back at another time when I'm in a better mind state to be able to see these patients.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Dr. Sabata? Okay, hearing none, then we will move into board deliberations.
This is Mr. Greer. I appreciate Dr. Sabata's candor. Unfortunately, the gravity of this situation is immense. I would like to believe that he went and saw the rest of his patients, but the actions taken to hide this visit are very, very troubling to me. And, you know, I think we need to have our full range of disciplinary actions available to us. So I'm not sure if we can decide this today in an initial review. And so my initial thoughts are to send this to a informal interview. So we have our full range of options available to us. If the doctor licensee is going to agree to some kind of consent agreement, I think that's a good way to avoid that. But I don't see this as a non-disciplinary case. I think that it's a disciplinary case just because, and maybe it's my personal background, billing time is what I do. I sell time. And here not only you have, you know, a misrepresentation on that, you're dealing with patient care. And so, you know, I don't know what an appropriate consent agreement would be, but if a consent agreement is not reached, and the way I would probably structure a future motion would be, hey, let's offer him a consent agreement. If he doesn't accept it, let's bring him back for an informal hearing.
Okay. And Mr. Greer, what would be parts of the consent agreement that you would like to see potentially considered?
I would defer to my more experienced member of the board on that one. I don't really know how I want this case to end, actually.
Well, we have three allegations, and it sounds as though from investigative report and the interview that all three are substantiated, right? Engaging in performing substandard care, charging unreasonable and fraudulent pleas, and making misleading, deceptive, untrue, fraudulent representations in his documentation and billing. And while I want to believe it was an isolated event, it is significant when you falsify a record and you to the point that you document vital signs and things that you didn't actually ever do, and note the position of the patient and things when you actually didn't lay eyes on them. So it's more than just for me. You know, adding an extra charge to the day when I actually only saw the patient for 15 minutes and I charged for 30. This whole note was created fraudulently. And so it's concerning. So it's not something that really should ever happen.
So I agree with you, Dr. King. I think what is difficult for me about this case is, and again, you know, I know all of our personal experiences go into all of this, but I think, you know, the candor I think is important to me because frankly, it would be very hard to prove this if it weren't for his candor. And I think I agree with you, Dr. King and Mr. Greer, that this is very serious stuff, right? And it's something that is a huge problem. And something that really concerns me. I'm swayed by his candor in that, you know, at least for this one instance, you know, he seems to be open and honest about it. I'm curious, you know, I know the board does a pretty thorough investigation. And I don't know, Judy, I think we typically look at kind of the surrounding, was that done in this, or not the surrounding treatments, was that done in this case?
The surrounding treatments, do you mean previous treatments like, for this patient specifically?
Well, what I'm curious is there any evidence the follow-on treatment was also fraudulent or not done? Can we look at that? Did we look at that?
You're talking about the treatments after this specific patient?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't honestly tell you for sure if those records were pulled.
Okay. I mean there's I think we all have concerns on that front, right? And I think that's reasonable. That's kind of where I stand. I think there should be some benefit because of the candor. I think the candor does really frankly it helps us in our job and it makes it it clarifies a lot of what we're looking at. I don't think that removes the fact that this is a serious violation that I think needs to be addressed. I'm not even sure I disagree with Mr. Greer that it may need to be addressed through a disciplinary process. But I am swayed by that honesty and that candor and frankly the remorse that we've heard.
Yeah, I would be in agreement as well. You know, I definitely can empathize with what the situation was, but I also understand that this is a very serious issue. I'm in agreement with you, Josh Barton, that I'd like to potentially see some of the documentation for the rest of the patients in that day, just to kind of see what happened with the rest of the treatments, and make sure everything is kind of on the up and up with that. I don't think it necessarily means that I would, you know, be moving to, support a disciplinary action as opposed to a non-disciplinary action. But I think it's just hard to make that decision without everything, you know, being in front of us.
So what I'm hearing you say is potentially request additional investigative information around the medical records for the patients for the remainder of his day to look for consistencies or inconsistencies. And then at that point, we could make a determination on was it truly isolated or did it spread through the day? And we have a little more to think about. Is that what you're summarizing?
That would be my thought process. Okay. Yeah. Which I think that goes along with Mr. Greer's original statement of taking it to an informal hearing more than one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me take a stab at a motion here.
Okay.
I would move that we offer the licensee a disciplinary consent agreement, with the following findings, filing discipline, a decree of censure, order the licensee to take the Pro-B ethics course within 1 year, 10 hours of continuing education in the area of ethics, but we will accept the ethics courses that he has already taken, and probation for 1 year. With early termination available. If the licensee does not accept this consent agreement, invite him back for an informal hearing and instruct staff to obtain the records of the other patients seen on the date in question. Does that work, Mark?
Mr. Greer, members of the board, it does. Implicit in your motion, Mr. Greer, are you adopting the findings and conclusions set forth in the investigative report?
Yes, as part of the consent agreement.
Yes.
For the purpose, and for clarify, for the purposes of the consent agreement, understanding that this is an initial review, if he doesn't accept that, we'll have to make a subsequent finding on these issues later.
Correct.
Can I get clarification, Josh? Were you saying he should take the Pro-B or do 10 hours of ethics and will accept the five?
No.
You want both? Okay.
And accepting the things that he's already taking and in addition to taking the
Pro-B. Yeah, I think it's 10 hours. I did the math real quick, but I'm a liar, not a...
Yeah, mm-hmm. When I counted, I think it was 13 total. So he would be open to 10 anyway.
I'll second the motion.
It was, 13. Well, one of them was actually not ethics. It was Medicare documentation, and that was 2 hours. So 11 hours of ethics.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we have a second.
Second.
Can I get just a piece of clarification on the motion itself? So including the Pro-B and 10 hours of ethics. And then, Mr. Greer, I'm sorry, there was a component after that about the 1 year probation.
Early termination available once he's completed everything.
Okay.
Yeah. And Judy, this is Mark. I also heard a decree of censure.
Yes.
And then I did also hear just for clarification that if the consent agreement is not signed, we move to a formal hearing and request additional investigative materials for the patient records for the remainder of that day.
And that probably will have to be via subpoena. I don't know if he's going to have access to those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We have a motion and a second. Are there any other questions regarding... the motion and the second. Mr. Sabaka, I see that your hand is raised. At this time, we aren't entertaining any questions or comments from you or Mr. Carey. Thank you. Any other points of discussion or concerns?
So I wonder, and this may betray a little bit of my ignorance on this, is there a reason for the 1 year probation? I'm wondering if the Pro-B ethics course, I wonder, he ought to be able to get that done in 6 months.
And then he can come back and ask us to terminate his probation.
Yeah. You know, Mr. Greer, would you be open to a 6-month probation instead of a 1 year?
I want the probation to run with the time he has to complete everything. Okay. And so that's why I did it that way. But I do understand if he wants to get up and get this taken care of and come back and say, I've done it, you terminate my probation, that's something we right. do on a regular basis. Yeah.
Is there a certain amount of time that has to go by before he can ask for early termination of that? Like if he gets it done in the next month, could he potentially ask for it to be done at that point?
Yeah.
Okay. Without hearing any further discussion, Judy, do you mind calling a vote?
It has been moved and seconded to offer a consent agreement that adopts the findings of fact and conclusions of law as outlined in the investigative report for a 1-year probation to include a decree of censure, a requirement to complete the probie ethics course, 10 hours of continuing education in ethics, accepting the courses that have already been completed. And if the consent agreement is not signed, the matter would be moved to an informal hearing and additional investigation regarding the remainder of the visits on that day would be requested of staff. Dr. King? Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Greer? Mr. Barton?
Yes.
Motion passes.
Thank you, Dr. King.
Thank you, Dr. Sabatka. Thank you, Mr. Carey. The board staff will be in touch with you, Dr. Sabatka, on details and be able to share more information with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. King, we need to stop the recording, please, and restart. Okay. So the recording is being stopped at 10:27.